Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Lean and Mean, presented by Comfort Dental, where we help dentists learn how to truly own their own practice. I'm your host, Judy, joined as always by the one and only Dr. Rick Kushner. Doc, how are you today?
Just great. Glad to be back and anxious to move forward.
Excellent. I'm so excited to pick up where we left off. On our last episode, we were really starting to dive into the aspects of purchasing a practice and the partnership that goes with it. Let's do a quick recap, then jump right back in.
Sure. I believe the last things we talked about were getting 25 to 35 new patients each month per doctor, trying to maintain a 70% recall system, and then finally, purchasing a practice that's been around for no less than around 5 years.
That's exactly right. And I believe you were going into practices up to 25 years. Does that sound right?
Yes, that is right, Judy. Thank you. On the 25-year end, I simply want the buyer to be a little cautious. Frequently, the 25-year-old practice has slipped into that leisure phase we talked about last time. I might approach it a little differently. The partnership can certainly be sold. I might offer a little less money.
That makes sense. 25 years is a long time. What else?
The next criteria to satisfy before you can meet the basic rule of thumb, half of last year's gross collections for the first partnership purchase price, is debt structure. And this formula assumes no debt on the practice. Many of you don't fit into that category, and I get it. It's okay to have debt. But if so, it only makes sense that you need to reduce the purchase price by what percent of the debt? 50%. Capital expenditures are always handled 50-50.
Split right down the middle.
That's right. But to me, it makes more sense to advise the selling doctor, if there's debt on the practice, keep the debt, use a portion of the buying partner's purchase price to retire the debt, and keep the debt out of the formula altogether. Because again, in its basic form, the formula assumes no debt. And then just let the formula hold. Notice I also didn't mention equipment or any hard assets at all in appraising a practice. The hard assets can and should be relatively insignificant if the rest of those major criteria are satisfied. You appraise your practice, regardless of what the buyer's accountant attempts to do, you appraise your practice from an earning potential, or better yet, an established earning level standpoint. Too much of an issue is made of the equipment list. Is it functional? Can we treat patients? That's all that matters. I always advise the seller to not sell real estate. If the seller does wish to sell real estate, I've always advised that it be done at a separate time and in a completely separate transaction. And again, from the selling doctor's standpoint, the reasoning is simple. You'll flat out get more money.
More money? That's a good thing.
I'd say so. The market has told us that if the real estate is sold separately, the total price received for the practice and the real estate is greater than if the real estate is included in the transaction. That includes the practice sale. But to me, again, making most sense is for the seller, owner of real estate, to just sell a portion of the practice and keep ownership of the real estate and rent it back to the partnership of which he or she is a part at fair market rates. And wear two hats, one as the tenant partner and one as the landlord. And that's what I've done. And they're all rented back at fair market rates to the partnerships. So again, when I say no real estate in the transaction, that is the reasoning behind that. And I must clarify, a few Comfort Dental practices are owned by my owner management team, a relatively small percentage. We rent many locations too. I want that to be completely honest.
Well, that makes total sense. Might be a little bit more work, but certainly worth it. How do you land on a fair price or rate?
Well, we've discovered that a fair price is a price in which the buying partner can recapture his purchase price in net income in a 2-year period of time. That's net income before servicing the debt. This is crude, but it's a pretty good safeguard. Net income before servicing his debt.
I see.
To illustrate this, a ratio could be set up between overhead and purchase price, or more accurately, between net profitability of the practice and purchase price. We'll assume that the two-doctor practice will gross $100,000 for simplicity's sake, and that is done at a 50-50 ratio. Each doctor does half of that. That's very rare, but let's keep it simple, or $50,000. In the first example, under 50% overhead. The net would be 50%. The appraisal of the whole practice using the formula would be $100,000. Dr. B's purchase price, half of that would be $50,000. 2 years' income for Dr. B, he produces and collects $50,000 at a 50% overhead or net. So he nets 50% of the $50,000 or $25,000 per year or per period. For 2 years, we're talking years, 25 plus 25 is 50. In a 2 year period of time, he recaptured his purchase price exactly. Therefore, he paid the ultimate fair price. In my view, in Lean and Mean Group view, he paid the ultimate fair price for the practice.
Thank you for breaking that down in such a simple way.
Let's look at how we might, in the same kind of formula, how we might devalue this thing in a practice with a higher overhead and see if he'd still be paying a fair price. Tough to follow. Just verbally, just audio. So you might want to listen again. But under the 60% overhead, the net would be 40. The appraisal of the whole practice now, using the ratio, 50% to 100,000 equals 40% to 80,000. Appraising the whole practice at 80,000, Dr. B would pay for half of this practice, then 40,000. Did he pay a fair price? He nets 40% of the $50,000 he produces each year, more accurately collects. When I ever say the word produce, you should hit me and make me say collect. Production means nothing. That's a different story. Mm. Or 20,000 plus 20,000, totaling 40,000, which is exactly what he paid. Again, he paid a fair price for half of that practice. He paid less, but he netted less. So, in fact, paid a perfectly fair price.
Math is easy. And it sounds like fair prices are easy, too. Should we take it a step further?
Yeah, but we're getting a little crazy here. Let's get a little extreme for a moment. In the third example, practice is badly managed and has a 90% overhead, and hence only a 10% net. And by the way, these exist to this day all too commonly. Using the ratio... Net to appraisal, 10% net, practice to total practice now would appraise at just $20,000. So how much would Dr. B pay for half of this practice? $10,000. How much would Dr. B earn each year for 2 years? He nets 10 of the 50 he produces collects, or 5 each year for 2 years, totaling $10,000. So he didn't pay very much at all for this practice. He netted in 2 years the $10,000 that he paid. So in this formula, although this is crazy, he did in fact pay a fair price for that practice.
It takes money to make money, or so they say. The more you put in, the more you can get out.
Sure. And say, you kind of like the sound of this, but even at the 50% level, you don't think that quite makes it for you in the way of a purchase price. Because you've established these things from ground zero, 15 or 20 plus years ago. You've nursed these things, this thing, from a pup with your blood, sweat, and tears. You've been a pillar of the community, and because of all this, you don't think 50% or half of last year's gross collections quite makes it for you. You think you should simply get more money for half this practice. I'm going to suggest that we're pushing the limit at half of last year's gross collections for the first partner, and suggest that you attempt to get more out of this purchase in a slightly different way, and you might call it A founding father's fee.
A founding father's fee?
Yeah. Now, in our franchise role of today at Comfort Dental, we call it a royalty, just to clear the air. But we called it a founding father's fee for many years, and it might be 1 or 2%, let's say, using that number as an example, off the top. Just like overhead, just like rent or salaries, before any doctor's pay distribution is considered, 1 or 2%, whatever you can negotiate. I'm taking the senior seller partner side on this one now. It's considered a kind of an override or a founding father's fee. We might call it a management fee, perhaps even a consulting fee to legitimize that. That's a lot of what the junior or buying partner is purchasing, the expertise of the senior or selling partner.
I see.
Now, are there people who will pay this kind of money? There was an article one time in one of our periodicals that says that after the debt service is paid and the horrific dental school debt, the student debt, there's nothing left out of annual income. So if that's reality, when people are looking at that kind of cost for a scratch start, will they pay similar money for an established earning level in your practice? You bet they will. You bet they will.
Yeah.
Not hundreds of thousands of them, but there are some.
I see.
Now let's talk about allocation, just so you have some ammunition when you talk to an accountant or a tax attorney. Not my expertise, but I've had so many of them. I know a little bit about this. As far as taxes go from the seller's standpoint, spread out the tax liability. But let's list some items for allocation. Goodwill. From the buyer's standpoint, this is not depreciable, and the buyer does not prefer to buy goodwill. Equipment. The buyer can depreciate. In any case, if we allocate to equipment, we must, to a certain degree. It must be a fair depreciated market value. I don't recommend that you mess around with the equipment. Whatever that fair depreciated market value is, allocate that much to equipment. Again, for the seller, it's a capital gain, but it's treated like ordinary income.
You've mentioned equipment a couple of times now. Tread lightly with equipment, folks. What's next?
Records. The buyer can depreciate from the seller, just like goodwill. Doesn't matter to the seller, but from the buyer's standpoint, this is legitimate. He or she's buying into an existing practice with existing patient records. And again, one thing we talk about is that he buys equal access to all the records of the practice. So records are depreciable, and we can establish a dollar amount per record, and the buyer prefers to buy records.
So to recap, from the buyer's standpoint, these are the top considerations from an allocation standpoint. Goodwill, equipment, and records. They're all depreciable. All great information, Dr. K. Thank you so much. Where do we go from here?
Judy, thanks for the recap. Now, I have mentioned that in the trial period agreement, there is no non-compete clause. And that is a fact in our situation and the one I recommend. But our Articles of Partnership buy-sell agreement definitely has a non-compete agreement. So this is legitimate, and it's depreciable for the buyer. Seller doesn't care. There's no capital gain on it, but it doesn't make any difference to the seller. We used to say the buyer does not wish, or we could not ask the buyer to buy supplies because it's treated as ordinary income to the seller. Well, everything's ordinary income for the seller, so it is no longer a disadvantage to the seller to sell supplies.
And how about the buyer?
Tremendous advantage to the buyer. So a wonderful thing you can do for your buyer, sellers, is to sell supplies, allocate to supplies. Because the buyer gets a current expense or deduction, and that's always better than a depreciable item right now, for the year of the purchase. So the buyer gets a current deduction or a current expense from supplies. and you'll have to treat it as ordinary income, but everything's treated as ordinary income to the seller.
Feels like another point to drive home. Everything is treated as ordinary income to the seller.
The lease and the leasehold improvements. Two more items that are depreciable.
Potentially depreciating assets. They're everywhere.
And again, the seller doesn't care. Now, one thing the seller can do is play with the calendar a bit, and it's legitimate. I mentioned a trial period span of 6 to 18 months in the last session. Mm-hmm. We might alter that time span for the calendar for the seller's tax situation. A 13-month trial period is very reasonable for a partnership of this type. If it goes out to 60 months, or maybe even 48 or 36 months, I think the IRS could legitimately say, hey, you're holding that deposit too long. It's no longer a deposit, and it's taxable now. In all honesty, what we've done with our recent transactions, for the most part, we've allocated fair market value to equipment, as I stated. We've sold as many supplies as we could to give the buyer a current deduction. And everything else, we've allocated to a non-compete covenant.
So the tax implications don't really even come into effect until over a year down the road. Is that right?
Yes, doctor's pay distribution is a big part of this form. And I apologize for the tax details here. It's a necessary thing, I hope you agree, but it's not very fun. Doctor's pay distribution is a big part of this format. This is an equal opportunity partnership, but this is tough now. Not necessarily an equal partnership.
And what's the difference there?
We're guaranteeing, by virtue of the contract, equal opportunity to produce enhanced collect for both or all partners. But how well each takes advantage of his or her opportunity is variable, and doctor's pay is based on that. To all the resources of the practice, the facility, the schedule, the staff, the patients, the equipment, the supplies, and so forth, we are assuring equal access to all of these resources. But some individuals, I'm told I go too fast, but I want to go really slowly here. Some individuals will make better use, some much better use, and some worse use of these resources than others, and doctors' pay month to month is based on that.
Another case of you get out what you put in. How does the money work with a partnership like that?
Now, we want one and only one checking account for the partnership. Two of the cornerstones to anything that we do and have done over these many, many years are fairness and simplicity. All expenses for the practice are paid by a certain time in the month. Let's say, for example, the cycle runs from the 15th of one month to the 15th of the previous month. Well, we've generally done it from the first to the end of the month, but it doesn't matter as long as you're consistent. By the 15th of the month, in this example, all the expenses are paid. The rent, the salary, the supplies, the lab bills, the utilities, the marketing, and on and on and on. We're completely up to date. We're completely current with all vendors by the 15th of the month. You need to be able to be current with all your vendors completely debt-free by a certain day every month.
Fairness and simplicity. Awesome in theory. So everything is paid up. What about the rest of the money?
The remaining money in the account, after the last bill has been paid and after the last deposit for the 15th has been made, is what we might call the doctor's profit or salary pool.
Yay to simplicity.
What could be simpler? Everybody else gets paid. If there's any money left over, we get paid. No automatic salary or draw.
I can feel the fairness part coming up.
Yep. How do we divide the doctor's profit or the doctor's salary pool? We divide this pool based on our percentage of what? production? No. Percentage of collection for the previous 30 days, same period of time. I would never be involved in a situation in which the doctor that did the most production, which contributed to collection, did not get paid the most. It's simply the fairest as well as the simplest way to handle this.
Absolutely makes sense. The more you do, the more you get.
Let's say it's a three-doctor partnership in a lean and mean group system. Doctors A, B, and C. Dr. A, during the past 30-day cycle, did production which contributed to collection, which accounted for 40% of the overall office collections. Dr. B, 35% of the overall office collections. And Dr. C, the remaining 25% of all overall office collection. All collection is attributed to one of the doctors, but everything totals 100%. So Dr. A's draw or paycheck is then 40% of the remaining profit pool, B, 35% of the pool, and then C, the remaining 25% of the pool.
Which totals the 100 in a fair and simple way.
That's correct. We zero out the account every single month of every year. Then another question comes up. I just mentioned it. I'm nervous about zeroing out the account every single month of the year. I'm afraid a big expense will come up the next day, or a compressor will go out, or whatever, and we'll get caught short. The partners must agree on what the floor would be. If you agree, there'll be a permanent floor fine, maybe $1,500 or $2,500 or $5,000 or $25,000. If you agree on it, again, I'm not going to make a big deal about it. But that leads us to another thought. In the system I just described, does the biggest producer, hence collector, pay the biggest share of the overhead?
That sounds fair to me.
All right, let's all think about it. The answer is without a doubt, yes. The biggest producer pays the biggest share of the overhead in this system. If A does 60% of the overall office collection, Dr. B does 40%, there's no question that 60% of Dr. A's collection goes toward overhead and 40% of Dr. B's goes towards overhead. We think it's fair because in turn, the biggest producer, hence collector, ends up with the biggest share of the doctor's profit pool. And then ultimately, if that pattern continues over a length of time, that big producer collector would have a bigger equity portion in the practice as well.
I appreciate how clearly you're breaking all of this down. Did you want to touch on lab fees?
Sure, and thank you for saying that I'm clearly breaking this down. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it. Lab fees. We think lab fees should be taken off the top like other overhead. Lab fees mean big production, mean big collection, mean big contribution to overhead, mean bigger share of the profit pool for Dr. A, and ultimately, Drs. B and C, the symbiotic relationship. For example, in a two-doctor practice, Drs. A and B, A has 40% of his or her overall production in Crown and Bridge. Dr. B has only 5% of his personal production collection in Crown and Bridge. That could be construed as unfair in this system. But I would look closer at another characteristic, which we might describe as clinical compatibility. And that goes back to the beginning. Why is it that this disparity exists in the first place? Why is one doctor consistently seeing a DO restoration while the other doctor consistently sees a crown on the same tooth? These doctors may not be clinically compatible and maybe shouldn't be partners in the first place. This is an equal opportunity partnership. It is also not designed so that one doctor can do all the Crown and Bridge and dump all the junk on the junior or buying partner. That is not the type of system this is. So those concerns need to be addressed ideally in the trial period, but that's the way we do it.
So it's not just where you purchase, what you purchase, how you purchase, and how you collect. It's who you're doing the whole thing with. Make sure you work well together and separately. Make sure you're both capable partners.
That's the way we've done it for many, many, many years, now decades now. And it's what we still recommend. What I'm showing here is a two-doctor relationship in which one doctor's personal production collection basically stays the same while the other one gets better and better. We're looking at the effect on the lesser doctor.
Not quite the fair approach you previously described.
In the first example, the practice collects $40,000. The overhead's $20,000 of it, leaving a salary pool of $20,000. Collections were done on a 60-40 percentage, 60 for Dr. A, 40 for Dr. B, or a $24,000-$16,000 ratio. Even in our heads, we could compute the paychecks for Drs. A and B. It would be $12,000 for Dr. A and $8,000 for Dr. B, so that's our baseline. And make sure you're comfortable with that example. Dr. A gets 60% of the $20,000 pool, or $12,000, and B gets 40% of the $20,000 pool, or $8,000. In the next example, I'm slowing down on purpose. An extra $1,000 comes in for Dr. A. The question is, how does that affect Dr. B's paycheck? That's the question. There are other overhead factors involved that I'm fully aware of, but they don't change the concept.
Mm-hmm.
So an extra $1,000 comes in for Dr. A, and the percentages change from 60-40 in the first example to 61-39 in the second example. So Dr. A's paycheck, you'll need to trust me on the figures unless you want to check me as we go along. Dr. A's paycheck becomes $12,810. His percentage went from 60 to 61. His paycheck went up naturally. Now, Dr. B's percentage went from 40 in the first example to 39. His percentage went down. But pay attention now. Dr. B's paycheck went up. Always up. We're cutting a bigger piece of the pie. We're splitting a bigger piece of the pie. Dr. B's paycheck didn't go up quite as much as Dr. A's in this example. It would be 8,190,000 for Dr. B, but nevertheless, it went up.
And up is a good thing.
Always. Dr. A's good fortune affects Dr. B favorably, and in every case it does. So even though Dr. B's percentage goes down, his paycheck goes up in every case. I'm uncomfortable now. I should insert this. If this disparity, gets much beyond 60-40, I think it could be argued that Dr. A, if he's the 60% and it goes much beyond that, he is bearing or sharing too big of the overhead load. That's a point. In an equal opportunity situation, one doctor doing more than 50% better than the other, maybe they shouldn't be partners together. That's a big disparity. But what we have seen typically in the first partnership situation, Dr. A, the senior doctor, is doing 60. Dr. B is doing 40. The practice typically has a 50% increase in production and collection and a 2 or 3 point reduction in operating expense overhead. And as the months and years go by, the 60% disparity gets closer to 50-50. And we've seen it hundreds of times, not the other direction. If it goes the other direction, I become concerned. With equal opportunity, that's a huge difference.
You've said it, I've said it, fair and simple. And we will certainly hear more about all of that when we return on the next episode of Lean and Mean. For myself, Judy, for Dr. Rick Kushner, and for all of Comfort Dental, we thank you for tuning in and look forward to our next episode.